Our last speaker this morning is Dr. Nina Glass, and she is an assistant professor at Rutgers University in Newark, New Jersey.
Good morning, y'all. I'm kind of curious, who in the audience is a rural surgeon? Can I get a show of hands? And what about general surgeons in big cities? Trauma surgeons? So I think that this is an important topic because obviously ultrasound is becoming really standard of care for a lot of the procedures that we do at the bedside. And you'll see that with some of the coding because actually ultrasound is incorporated into the codes for a lot of the procedures that have been mentioned that we're going to be talking about. I do not have any relevant financial disclosures, but I do disclose that I'm a trauma surgeon. A lot of the ultrasound I do looks like this, and so I admit that it's sometimes hard to store these images. They're done in the emergency setting, and unfortunately, storage of the images and putting them in the medical record is essential to getting to bill for them. And so I think that it's, you know, and we'll talk about that. So just a brief outline of my presentation. I'm going to talk about the objectives here, talk about some primary reasons for ultrasound. Obviously, most of what we're talking about here is ultrasound to support a procedure, but occasionally you can do a diagnostic ultrasound. And if you need a diagnosis before you do your procedure, then I think that it's appropriate to bill for that as well. I'm going to talk a little bit about the requirements of documentation. It's not exactly straightforward. Some of the common CPT codes that we see, some of the important CPT modifiers to know about, and some important information on payer policy. So why do we care about coding, right? This isn't, I don't have cool videos like the rest of the speakers or pictures of my ranch. But I think it's really important. As a attending, it's the first time that I've had to actually be responsible for my own billing, and I think it's really important to be able to accurately code the services that you're providing. It's important to be able to support the services, for example, the money to buy the ultrasound machines in our practice or the ICU, and it's really important to be properly reimbursed for your work and to do all this stuff ethically and efficiently. So who determines coding and billing? I'm going to use some of these abbreviations in my presentation and just wanted to mention them here. So the CPT codes, obviously we know are the current procedural terminology, CMS, you know, it's a big payer, so it has certain special rules for certain things. Professional organizations have made a lot of the recommendations for how to ensure quality of ultrasound and kind of dictate how we do some of these things. So bedside ultrasound, obviously we've just talked about it. It's a medical imaging technique that can be used to evaluate conditions. It can diagnose a mass or describe it. It can be used in trauma, so we use a lot of fast ultrasound, or to survey things like a AAA or the biliary tree. And it can be used for the assistance with a procedure. So often ultrasound can be billed in addition to those procedures. And I'll mention kind of some of those examples. For example, other abscesses. Unfortunately, things like ultrasound guidance for a thoracentesis or paracentesis, those are often incorporated within the code. Some of them are incorporated within the codes for biopsies and things like that as well. So what are the requirements for billing any ultrasound? All the imaging needs to be permanently recorded with images and measurements in the chart. I appreciated what Dr. Sims said about making sure that you record an image showing that that you've actually biopsied the lesion. The same for when you're talking about imaging for ultrasound guidance of line placement. With the ultrasound guidance, you don't actually have to get the pictures when your needle is in the lesion for line placement and for procedures, because they're assuming that you're busy doing that procedure, doing that part of the procedure. So that's not the important part that needs to be documented. But I often try to document when the wire's in place or the drain is in place afterwards, so to show that I've done the job. And you need to document your interpretation. That includes having the physician or whoever's doing the ultrasound, and also the patient and the patient ID number. And it also has to include a medical necessity. I found that most of the time when I'm denied for compensation for these kinds of things, it's because my medical necessity wasn't adequate for the payers. So requirements for billing diagnostic ultrasound. When you're billing a separate diagnostic ultrasound, And those are going to be the 7 codes that we're going to talk about briefly. A written signed report is by the interpreting clinician is required. The report has to include specific components. It's not quite clear what those are. I'm going to talk about that in the next slide. If the required elements for a complete exam are not reported, then you either have to bill for the limited exam or for reduced services if there's not a limited exam available. And if you're evaluating vascular structures, I think we mentioned this earlier, you can use both color and spectral Doppler, and they're separately reportable. But if you only use color, it's just the same as kind of your standard vascular ultrasound. So how do you document your interpretation? As I mentioned, there's different guidelines based on different organizations. Per CMS, the interpretation of the ultrasound has to include relevant clinical issues, comparative data, if there are any, and study findings. The American College of Radiology has different guidelines. They describe that you need to describe how you did the procedure, the materials used, so like what kind of probe, et cetera, and any limitations in the study. If you didn't get a good, particularly good view, those should be included, as well as your clinical impression, conclusions, or diagnoses. So again, a lot of this stuff isn't really spelled out for CPT, but there's a lot of guidelines out there from various professional organizations that suggest what we should be doing. And so I think it's just important to be very clear in your documentation what exactly you've seen. What about requirements for billing ultrasound for procedural support? For these, you do not need a separate dictation or a separate note. However, this can be included within your dictation for the procedure. You do have to include medical necessity and interpretation of the results, and I think that it's important. It's probably best to include those in a separate paragraph within your procedure or your operative report to make it clear exactly what was done, if there's any audit that needs to be done for your bill. And then it is possible to bill more than one imaging code. You just need that 51 modifier. Like Dr. Sims mentioned, you might bill for a wire localization and then for sentinel node. Or in an example that I thought of was when you're doing a central line, if you were to use ultrasound to get access and then fluoroscopy to confirm that you're in the right place, those are not bundled, so you could potentially bill for both of those codes. What about requirements for quality assurance and quality improvement? According to CMS, the professional component, which is usually the physician interpretation, which is what I'm going to talk about in a moment, is not subject to any accreditation requirement. So from everything that I could find, it seems like the technical component is what requires really significant quality controls. So there's guidelines from the Association for the American Institute of Ultrasound Medicine and the American College of Radiology that document very specifically, if you have your own equipment, how to maintain that, how to do daily checks on certain things, annual checks on other things, to make sure that the probes are in good condition, that you're getting quality images. And so that's usually a requirement of whoever's providing the equipment. On the other hand, I think that it's good practice to have a good quality assurance program for your ultrasounds. So, and the American College of Emergency Physicians is the program that I'm most familiar with because that's what we use in our institution. We review all of our ultrasounds as a group to make sure that we're providing good quality images and review any problems so we can improve. However, like I said, there's not a firm guideline on how that has to be done. So let's talk a little bit about diagnostic ultrasound CPT codes. These are arranged anatomically. Some are complete versus limited. I'm going to put up a list here, but obviously it's a lot of numbers, and you know you can look all these up. It's just important to remember, you know, for example, you're looking at the head and neck, or the chest, or the breast. There might be complete or limited exams, and if you're not providing a complete exam, for example, you're looking only at the biliary tree, it's important that you use the code that bills for the limited exam for the abdomen. Otherwise, you're going to be responsible for coding all of the normal structures in that region. This is just a table of some of these codes, and I also listed the work RVUs here. You know, as much as I think that this is important, and I'm up here telling you guys about this, you can see that none of the RVUs are over 1. So we're not talking about a lot of reimbursement. And this is just for the technical, for the professional component. This technical component is often 2 to 3 times more than this. And so if you are in a private clinic and you have your own equipment, you might be able to bill for that as well. But in terms of the professional component, just the reports that I'm talking about providing, it's not a lot of money. We're talking about like $30 an exam here or something. What about for ultrasound CPT codes that are associated with a procedure? Some of these are category one codes, some of them are add-on codes, and some of the procedure codes that we're going to be using actually include the image guidance bundled with the code. And it's important to be somewhat familiar with those so that you know when you can add an additional code for image for ultrasound guidance. So these are some of the add-on codes for vascular access, for example. If you're using an ultrasound to access for a line, I think that it's important to use this. And as I mentioned, you do need to record your images and your interpretation within your procedure note. However, you do not need to have the image of your needle actually entering the vessel. You just need an image showing that you identified the vessel. And the rationale for that is that, you know, while you're getting into the vessel, presumably you're busy with that part of the procedure, and so you're not going to be able to necessarily save your images. There's also a code for ultrasound-guided needle placement. Again, you can add that on to procedures, for example, an abscess drainage, which is 10060, I think, for a simple abscess. But for a lot of the more complicated things like thoracentesis or paracentesis, or even biliary drain placement, it's actually a component of the code. And so you can't bill an additional ultrasound-guided needle placement for those codes. Here is a list of some of those codes that include ultrasound guidance. So you might do a pericardiocentesis. You might use an ultrasound intra-op to guide anything, actually. So you might use an ultrasound to help you localize a lesion before you resect it, to map out the biliary tree before you do your cholecystectomy. And you can bill for that with this ultrasound guidance intra-op with a modifier. There's also unlisted ultrasound if you're doing things that are not necessarily part of one of these procedures. FNA is one of the codes that includes image guidance as part of it. Arthrocentesis, there's several, you know, small, medium, or major joints or bursa spaces. If you aspirate the pleural space or you insert a thoracentesis catheter, those codes include image guidance. The same with abdominal paracentesis or things like placement of a biliary catheter. And you can see I've also included the RVUs here. I'm glad that Dr. Sims went over breast CPT codes a little bit because, like he said, it's quite complicated. And I don't do any breasts in my practice now, so I am not that familiar with these. However, similar to other breast codes, you know, if you're doing more than one breast biopsy, for example, you can see there's an add-on code to identify biopsying several lesions. The same for placement of breast localization devices. You can bill for more than one of those if you're placing more than one, if you have more than one lesion. So now what about modifiers? As I mentioned, there's some really important modifiers you need to know about when you're talking about ultrasound. Some of these are gonna be for the, just for ultrasound in general. For example, I mentioned the idea of the professional component versus the technical component. If you don't put a modifier, then it's assumed that you're billing for the global code, which includes both of these. In the hospital setting, it's always assumed that the technical component, that's the provision of an ultrasonographer and also all the equipment, is coming from the hospital. So you can't bill the technical component in the hospital. If you have your own equipment in your own office that's freestanding and not a part of the hospital, then I think that it's certainly reasonable to bill for all of that. And as I mentioned, that's the majority of the reimbursement for many of these codes. But for anyone who's in the hospital or in an outpatient setting that's connected to the hospital, we always need to use a professional component modifier, which is a 26. And again, that is going to the person who's doing the interpretation. What about other CPT modifiers? So one thing that we come upon in trauma a lot is that we might be doing a procedure, for example, a serial fast exam or a repeat exam after somebody else has already performed that exam. And so a repeat procedure by the same physician uses a 76 modifier, or by another physician is a 77. And according to the CPT and CMS guidelines, the same physician is any physician that's in your group and with your same specialty. So any of the trauma surgeons in my group who surgeons in my group who bill for who repeat the procedure, we all count as the same physician. Whereas if, you know, a radiologist, if I do a procedure and then I ask the radiologist to confirm it, then they're a separate person, they're another physician doing the procedure. Or the ER physician doing the procedure as a repeat, that would be another physician. And again, if you're doing a serial exam, that's gonna be important to use. What is not allowed? So things that would be included in global, for example, if you use ultrasound guidance for a block, one that we use occasionally is ultrasound guidance for a rib block, for example, for patients who have rib fractures. If they have rib fractures and I'm doing it, you know, independently, then I can bill for that. But if it's perioperative, then I can't bill for that because that's pain management is bundled with the global package for those procedures, and so would the ultrasound guided pain block. Also, procedures without the correct documentation or without saved images. So many times I go to the chart to bill for my ultrasound, and I realize that the residents didn't save the images, and so they're no longer there. So I can't bill for those procedures. Also, if I have inadequate justification with medical necessity. So in trauma, again, these are a lot of my examples because I'm a trauma surgeon, but we do a fast exam to rule out any injuries. And if the patient has no injuries, I've gotten denials a lot because they say, oh, the patient didn't really need that exam. So you have to make sure that you're justifying it by, you know, the severity of the injury to begin with. What about tidbits about payer policy? So like I mentioned, certain diagnoses have been pre-approved for certain procedures. And so you have to think about, you know, if the procedure that you're doing maps with the diagnosis codes you're putting with it. Again, sometimes you can appeal these if you're denied, but if you put in the correct diagnosis codes to begin with, it makes it much simpler. Beware of bundling, especially like I mentioned, many of the intervention codes that we're talking about incorporate the ultrasound guidance into them or image guidance into them, and so you have to make sure that you're not double billing for that. However, it may be justified to bill, for example, a diagnostic ultrasound to make a decision, and then the ultrasound guided procedure code. Even though the ultrasound guided procedure code incorporates some of the diagnostics in there, if it was used to make your decision first, then I think that it's appropriate to bill for that as long as you document meticulously what you're thinking. And again, frequency, if you're repeating exams, it's very important to document the need to repeat that and to make sure you're using the correct modifiers for that. Because if you're billing for several procedures in a given 24-hour period, there might be a question of why and what was the medical necessity of that. So I actually took the coding course at the college over the past couple days, and I stole some of their models for how to ask these kinds of questions. So I have a couple of case examples to see what you guys think. The first is a 55-year-old man who has a superficial abscess in his left thigh. Here you can see a picture of that abscess. You're seeing him in your private office, and you assess that he needs an ultrasound-guided aspiration and a pigtail placement. You perform the procedure, and you print out the images to include in your chart. Your image does not necessarily visualize the needle going into the abscess. So what can you bill for this? So I assume that he's an existing established patient, and so you can bill your E&M for that assessment, and then you can bill the IND with the ultrasound guidance. And depending on if you have the equipment as part of your office or you don't, you need that 26 modifier versus billing for the global procedure. The next example is a man who you're called to see in septic shock in the MICU, and they call you to place a line. You document your line and include your ultrasound guidance as well as a photo of the imaging. So again, there's no guidance on how these images need to be included in the chart. They just have to be permanently documented. So if you have a way to, you know, our ultrasounds are linked to the PAC system and we can just upload those images, that's great. But if you can print out an image and put it in the paper chart, or even take photos and incorporate them into your notes. Those are all fine ways to incorporate an image. So in this case, I think that you can bill for ultrasound guided vascular access and insertion of a non-tunneled catheter. And again, for that ultrasound guided vascular access, you're in the hospital setting, so you need a 26 modifier for that. I don't think that you can necessarily bill for the critical care here. You're not making any decisions. You're not. You're just coming and doing this as a technician. And so that's what you're going to need to include in your note. Another example, again, this is the FAST example I was talking about. Especially for younger patients, we tend to try to triage their abdomens without using cross-sectional imaging with CAT scan. So we might admit the patient for serial abdominal exams and FASTs. So this patient was a pedestrian struck, you know, a significant trauma, but no loss of consciousness, normal exam. And her initial workup included a chest x-ray, a pelvic x-ray, and a FAST that was normal. You see her in the morning to repeat your FAST and then discharge her. So in this case, I think that you can bill for her hospital discharge, and you can bill for a FAST, which we traditionally use these three codes based on guidelines from the American College of Emergency Physicians, which are ultrasound exam of the abdomen limited, ultrasound exam of the retroperitoneum limited, and ultrasound exam of the chest. It's also a limited exam. And so now the question is, you need the 26 modifier for the professional component because you're in the hospital, and you need either a 76 or a 77 modifier depending on who did the first exam. So if it was an ER physician who provided the first exam, then I'm a separate physician and I would use the 77 modifier. But for my partner, you can use the 76 modifier because even though it's not me that did the first exam, it's part of my group, so we count as the same person. And that's all I have for you. I think we're finishing up a little bit early, but if you guys have any questions, I think we're all willing to take them. So thanks.
So this excellent session, I'd like to thank all of our speakers. We do have about 10 or 15 minutes for questions. So if there are any questions from the audience, we could certainly entertain those now. I have a question, a couple questions actually. So Cindy, Dr. Talley, when you are using ultrasound to drain an abscess, for example, are there situations where you're starting off with a planned approach for a two-stage procedure where you might drain the abscess initially and then use that drain as your approach if you want to do a minimally invasive, more operative type of drainage, and then where do you put imaging in necessarily into that scenario to maybe change your mind or develop your plan as far as whether or not you want to sort of upsize the drain?
Yeah, thanks for the question. I've used this before with the peripancreatic collections, mm-hmm. especially, so the step-up approach. If it's a large fluid collection down kind of both retroperitoneal gutters, I've actually put drains in on both sides and then just upsize them as needed for when they get clogged, anticipating that I may need to upsize. Although you don't really know what size French, you know, tube you need to put in at the beginning. If it's draining fine, then just leave it. But if you find it's getting clogged or needing to flush it more often, then sometimes I'll upsize it. And serial imaging is something that I'll do if the output is low, but they're still not completely resolved clinically, then I may image and see if there's still a kind of a refractory collection there that may need an upsize.
And would you choose CT imaging or repeat ultrasound imaging, or might it depend on the scenario?
Yeah, I've done both. If it's in a complicated area, I'll try to CAT scan if the patient's transportable, if they're not too sick to go. But actually, frequently, I will re-ultrasound the area even a few hours after I've drained. So even if I'm doing a drainage of a pleural effusion, I may put the ultrasound probe back on and make sure I got it all, or an abscess, make sure that it's collapsing. So I just keep the ultrasound probe ready.
Excellent. Question from the floor.
Yes, Eric Wiley in Brownwood, Texas. We're a fairly small hospital. We have two surgeons. I've been using ultrasound for outpatient breast biopsies and line placements. What would you recommend from a advancement and credentialing point of view to get more into the bedside procedures? So just show up one day in the ICU and everybody starts looking at you a little funny if you start getting an ultrasound machine out to do something on the abdomen, and how did y'all approach that?
So a lot of the hospitals actually have your privileges as ultrasound-guided procedures. And with that, it includes a lot of things, including thoracentesis and paracentesis. So abscess drainage is actually, you know, sometimes I bill it actually as a paracentesis. And cholecystostomy tubes are typically included in ultrasound-guided procedures. So as far as having the privileging, a lot of you may already have that.
We started doing the breast biopsies in the clinic, and my partner and I kind of started that. So we moved over into the hospital to do lines. There, after the first 10 we put in with ultrasound, there were these questions. We've been using ultrasound all the time in the clinic, and it kind of just went on through. Again, it is a smaller hospital. And so you're kind of on these credentialing committees, mm-hmm. but you want to do things appropriately. And I just didn't know if there were specific numbers of cases, mm-hmm. specific training. The breast we got to by going through Ethicon and Mammitome, their system, to get that in through credentialing. I don't know if there's any other specific programs that you would recommend for that.
So I'm familiar with many programs for credentialing for these kinds of things, and that's the issue, is that every organization has their own credentialing policy. So for example, the Society of Critical Care Medicine will provide you with, you know, an ultrasound course if you want to go. There's a society for bedside point of care ultrasound, SPOCUS, that also offers some options about what might be available in your area. And I mean, you're exactly right that unfortunately there's not a lot of, I mean, there's many options, and so you don't know which one to pick.
Yeah.
It depends on what you're looking for, but many of those societies say that once you've done 100, that's kind of the number you need to be, you know, credentialed. In our institution, as surgeons, we've all kind of been grandfathered into being credentialed for many of these procedures. But if you're looking for an official way to do it, one of those organizations might be a good place to go.
Every hospital is a little different, though. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know I can do it after 10 central lines, yeah. Instead of 100. Some organizations have chosen not to get involved in coming up with a specific number. So if you've attended a course, I've seen hospitals that take course certification that you've attended, say that applies.
The college generally runs two different courses at every clinical congress about ultrasound. So if you need didactic backbone, you can certainly access those as a fellow. Basically, I think on Saturday or Sunday prior to the clinical congress every year, both are relatively well attended and very well reviewed.
I think clarifying with your institution is important. Whether it's part of your training and you can document that for fresh grads coming out of a training program, I think is important. Sometimes you just need a letter from a program director. When you're already in practice, you're not going to go back, you know, and get some of that stuff. And if there's a large quantity of cases that you need to have in order to document, that seems unreasonable, especially if your institution really wants this as a practice or an offering that they have. So I think clarifying with your institution what the requirements are, whether it's a course that you can take either at a meeting like this or in your local environment, I think, you know, finding out from some of the reps for some of the equipment from these, they oftentimes are happy to provide you with some extra education to be able to do that. I wouldn't go above and beyond, you know, what is necessarily needed, but figuring out what exactly, there are lots of resources, I think, and I would hope that your institution would be supportive of new offerings that you want to be able to acquire as part of what you'd want to include into your practice.
I would also start with the chip shots. Something that's going to be pretty easy. And I will abort procedures occasionally if I think I'm going to do something, but it's just not looking right. The patient's not tolerating it, I'll abort it. So the last thing you want to do is start a program and then have some complications. So I think, you know, those are the patients you might need to transfer, ask your other radiology colleagues to help you with, but getting started slowly. You will have some groups of people who, you know, may think that's their territory and not yours. I haven't found that problem, but I know some others have.
Thank you.
And it's not like our radiology colleagues don't have some complications that fall in our laps afterwards, too.
Great question.
Patrick Malt from Fairfield, Illinois. More a comment than a question. Like in 1994, our radiologist at the hospital I was working at bought a stereotactic table, and I went to the spring meeting and took the college's stereotactic course, and they refused to let me use the stereotactic table, so I bought my own ultrasound unit and put them out of business. But a couple of tips in terms of doing breast work in particular. I do all the image-directed biopsies done with ultrasound in my small hospital. Mammotome will give you the base unit if you buy the needles, and your biopsies are a lot better with the mammotome than they are with a 16-gauge core. If you are going to use a small core biopsy, get one of the coaxial systems. I hate to product endorse, but Bard's Marquee system is really nice because you put the initial needle and trocar into the lesion, and then you can take multiple biopsies through the cannula without causing the patient any discomfort, and there are excellent markers that go through those. The other thing is your ultrasound markers, you need to make sure that they're fairly permanent. A lot of the ultrasound markers dissolve fairly quickly, and then you're in the OR, and if you're doing ultrasound excisions, I do ultrasound excisions rather than needle localized excisions. Occasionally I will use a needle to augment my ultrasound exam, but I don't do a preliminary procedure out on, you know, with radiologists. Excuse me. You know, and you get in there and you can't see your marker, you're really kind of messed up at that point, so you need to make sure it's a semi-permanent marker. I do what are called hug excisions. That's hematoma ultrasound guided excisions. It's a nice acronym. The acronym actually should have been a huge procedure, but nobody would want to have a huge procedure, so we do hug excisions. And one of the things that I do, which is well documented in the breast surgery literature, is to do an examination of the specimen after excision. And I actually use water for my interface for that. I plunk it in a basin of water and do the examination. If you have 6 millimeters of grossly clear margin around your lesion, about 95 or more percent of the time you're going to have histologically clear margin. So those are just a few tips for people who do breast ultrasound. The other thing is, if you're in a less than resource privileged environment, which I am, everything comes on a truck. Okay, we share a digital mammography unit with 3 other hospitals. It's on a van. We use a service that comes in with a stereotactic biopsy table. We have to contract for, I think, 10 visits a year or something. They bring the stereotactic unit in, they set it up in our radiology department. Anybody who was coming in wouldn't know that we didn't own it unless we told them. And another thing is, I actually bring my techs into the operating room with me. Rather than impeding myself by using a sonosite, I bring the diagnostic ultrasound unit from the department and the tech who originally found the lesion into the operating room with me, and that's greatly facilitated my procedures.
Outstanding. Thank you for those comments. Last question.
Yeah, good morning. Tim Burkseth. I'm a rural surgeon at a critical access hospital in northwest Wisconsin, and I primarily have a comment in regard to Dr. Sims' talk on the sentinel node biopsy. I've been in my practice 5 years, and the partner I joined had breast cancer prior to that. She said in her entire experience, the most painful part of that was having the radioisotope ejection done with her awake. And so I adopted her practice, which was to do that as the first thing that we do in the operating room once the patient is sedated. And you know, then by the time we do the positioning, the prep, I've never not had the sentinel nodes map. In fact, as soon as I do the radioisotope injection, I'll do gentle breast massage for a minute or two, put the navigator probe on the axilla, and there's already activity there. So that's just kind of a way that I found to kind of make the process a little bit quicker and do it all in the operating room.
Outstanding.
Comment on dye before we get out of the room. Are either of you using dye any longer?
Yeah, I'm using radioisotope and blue dye.
I stopped using it about 10 years ago or so. It went on national back order. It was hard to get lymphas urine. And honestly, I never found that I really needed it. I get over 95% localization of the node without it, so it's just an extra step. Frequently, it tattoos the woman's breast, and a lot of times that bluish tinge never goes away, at least in my hands. And I've had at least one allergic reaction, which was quite scary, and patients just don't like to see their family members come out of the OR with a pallor and you know, peeing green for a few hours, so I just don't use it anymore.
And I think that's definitely something you have to manage patient expectations ahead of the time. So I make sure to tell them that, look, your breast will be blue. It'll be blue for a while. Your urine, you'll have Smurf urine, just so that they're prepared for that. But I agree. I don't know that the blue dye adds a lot for me. And I have two colleagues who have had patients have anaphylaxis on the table from the blue dye. So it's also something I talk to them about prior to surgery.
It's also expensive.
Listen, that wraps it up.
Yep, thank you very much.
Thanks, everybody, for your questions.